UC Riverside political science professor Francisco Pedraza joins me now to talk about voter participation in the election. Welcome back, Francisco.
Hi, Megan. Good to be here.
We know that ballots are still being processed across California in the Inland Empire, but we know that we did have record voter turnout. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah, this was incredible for at least two reasons. One is that it tells us a lot about the amount of investment that took place at the ground level. Nonprofit community organizations, very grassroots oriented, have done a tremendous job of mobilizing voters. And what's important about that is that it complements a lot of the investments that political campaigns usually do to make sure that folks who have a habit of turning out come to the ballots. These nonprofit organizations, by contrast, have been investing in what we call low propensity voters. These are the individuals that you might predict or flag as less likely to turn out. They require a little bit more investment, and they require a relational connection. They need folks to put in the time and remind them what you have to do to register to vote, what the voting process is going to be like, and then continue that relationship and encourage them to turn out on election night, including providing information if they choose to participate in advance of election day. That's one huge thing to keep in mind. And then the other, right, is that we can't ignore that 2020 was unprecedented. We have a major historic election place taking place in the context of a pandemic. And so all of the typical routines and procedures that were already in place from the national to the state to the local level had to be revised, updated, and in some cases completely overhauled to take that into account. We wanted to make sure that voting wasn't going to put anybody in danger. So the fact that we have this tremendous turnout and participation, in many places we saw that early vote returns were at 80, 90, and in some cases even exceeding the total vote amount that we saw in the 2016 general elections. And that, in the context of a pandemic, is really quite impressive. It tells us a lot about how important people thought that this election was to turn out, even if it meant that they might be exposing themselves.
And then what about these, you know, we're having tensions nationally over the vote count continuing, and we're also seeing that locally. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, boy, there is another thing that we're in the middle of grappling with right now, and it's not just the count. It's how and why the count is at the top of everyone's mind, and it's saving. It's because there's been a shadow cast over the legitimacy of our elections processes. Much of this can, of course, be traced to President Trump's comments, starting with his responses when asked whether he would be willing to a peaceful transition of power should the outcome signal that Joe Biden is the winner. You know, he left that an open question. He said, well, we'll just have to see. And since the election, he's, of course, launched lawsuits in several states. And other Republican officials haven't sort of stopped him. There's actually been some really concerning statements, for example, from Mike Pompeo, his Secretary of State, who recently said that there was going to be a smooth transition to a second Trump administration. And that just, you know, that doesn't bode well, given our commitment to democracy, and what sets democracies apart from other kinds of regimes is that willingness to say, okay, we've lost this time, we consent to that loss, and we're going to turn the reins of power over to other folks. And that, unfortunately, doesn't only affect the president's the presidential election. It trickles down and influences, and we're concerned that it may start to undermine the kind of public trust that we have in our systems, all the way down to the state and the local levels. We want people to feel like elections officials have their game tight. They know exactly what they're doing. They have systems and checks in place to make sure that there's no fraud. And by the way, there has been zero evidence to show any kind of systemic fraud across the nation or in any particular jurisdictions. So it's very unlikely that fraud, if it occurred, will change any kind of outcomes. It's just extremely difficult to engage in electoral fraud. It just gets caught before it can make any kind of an impact. But the poisoning the well in terms of how people perceive it is deeply concerning. Even if the right or the correct or the people who actually won the most votes end up taking office, it leaves that seed of doubt. And that's something that we're going to have to grapple with as a nation.
So what you're saying is the big thing that's at stake is our form of democracy.
That's exactly right. This is a real undermining of those kinds of traditions and norms that we think set us apart from other nations. If you saw things in another country that were taking place here in the U.S. now, we wouldn't give it a second thought. We would say this is problematic. And I think that's important to keep in mind about how serious we ought to take what's happening right now. What's unfolding in front of us right now is unprecedented. I mean, there's certainly been attempts to exclude people from the ballot box and through intimidation. We've just never seen it on this scale.
Certainly. So what can the public do and ask of their leaders, their public leaders?
I think the most crucial thing is to insist that public leaders not tolerate any kind of language or any kind of moves that would undermine the credibility of election outcomes. So concretely, that means calling up elected officials to say, we insist that we call for a concession at the presidential level. And then after that, we insist that there has to be a clear reporting of what a recount involves and how this influences any outcomes if it does. And then finally, to follow up afterwards to say, our systems are intact and they're trustworthy. And we don't usually keep, you know, we don't usually make that kind of a message a priority, but I think it is better to err on the side of safety and make sure that that is emphasized and not lost. We should underscore that now and nip it in the bud.
So let's switch now to polling. We know now that they once again got it wrong. What happened?
So one thing that we need to keep in mind with polls is that they're only as good as the input that is used to make estimates. And we are coming to face with a very important reality in the polling industry. It has become increasingly difficult to get representative samples of a population. And it's the case for two reasons. Probably the biggest reason is because it's hard to get in touch with people who make up and are important parts of the population that we want to talk about. More people are walking around with cell phone lines, less people have landlines. So when you try to sample from an entire population and they have the option to not be included in lists that a pollster would use, it makes it hard to reach people. It's also hard to reach people just because they're busy. So even if we do have their phone numbers, even if we can get in touch with them, people have things going on. And so it makes it harder and harder to make time to answer pollster questions. And then finally, we have to keep in mind that we're an increasingly multicultural democracy, and all those grassroots organizations that I mentioned earlier and the impact that they're having on mobilizing voters, they've turned their attention to remember these low propensity voters, not all of which are fluent in English language. And what that means is that pollsters have to up their game and make sure that they've got the tools and the resources and personnel and talent that can adequately and appropriately reach out to those kinds of communities, including those that are not English language proficient. Otherwise, we miss them. And if without their voices inside of those final estimates, we risk not having accurate polling estimates that tell us what can we expect to be outcomes.
Mm. And those groups were the groups that we were concerned wouldn't be able to vote because they would miss out on information. And now it looks like they're the ones who didn't get polled correctly.
That's exactly right. Yep.
Interesting. And so these groups, I know that there's been some discussion about, you know, them treating certain groups like the Latinx community as a monolith, that's been a big problem. What have you seen about that conversation?
Yeah, I think right now what we're seeing is a tug of war on the narrative. help understand, well, which groups would we say should get credit for securing the victory, in this case, the presidential level, for the Biden-Harris ticket. And that's important, and we want to think carefully about that, because that also informs policymakers' choices about which kinds of issues that they should emphasize, who in the broader American community has needs that should be addressed, let's say, earlier rather than later, or in depth versus not at all. And so that's, I think, part of what's at stake when you hear conversations about, for example, the African-American vote or the Latino vote or the Asian-American vote. And there is a narrative right now that's talking about how when you break down the vote by race and ethnicity, we saw, like 2016, a majority of white voters cast their ballot in favor of Donald Trump, and a majority of non-white voters cast their ballot in favor of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. When we drill down a little further, we see that that breakdown, for example, among the African-American community, turned out to be crucial in some of those key battleground states, including Georgia, Wisconsin, and Michigan. Without that African-American vote in Atlanta, for example, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Detroit, Michigan, it's hard to see how Joe Biden would have secured a victory. By the same token, Latino voters, largely in response to some of the politics around SB 1070 and the extremely restrictive immigration enforcement tactics used by Sheriff Joe Arpaio in the Phoenix, Maricopa County area in Arizona, really tells you the story about how we got from Arizona being a reliable Republican-leaning state to one that flipped and is now likely to be blue moving forward. And without the Latino vote, and I would even say without the Native American vote, we would not have seen, I think, that flip. And so that is crucial and important, because so much action around issues that are important to African Americans in Georgia, Wisconsin, and Michigan may get elevated now as a result of the African American vote being seen as crucial for securing the Democratic Party candidates' fortunes. By the same token, over in Arizona, it's going to be increasingly difficult for state and local officials to ignore Latino concerns and their perspectives in policymaking processes, given their crucial role in securing the victories for Democratic candidates.
Sounds like something worth examining further in our increasingly multicultural society. Francisco Pedraza of UC Riverside, thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Megan.